This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If you plan on going to school to become a physical therapist, you should probably plan on going to school a little longer than you, well, planned.
They can go in immediately into physical therapy following their graduation from the program. Certainly they're prepared to do that, and there are a lot of jobs out there for them.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the new academic standards for physical therapists. We'll also hear what medical schools are and are not teaching students about alternative medicine. And then it's off to D.C., where a University of Maryland art professor has the hottest class on campus, and we'll spend an academic minute with a galactic hookup. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The educational standards for becoming a physical therapist are changing around the country. Every college physical therapy program in the U.S., except one, is changing to a Doctor of Physical Therapy program. Here to talk about this is Dr. George Stewart, Chair of the Department of Biology and Director of the School of Allied Health and Life Sciences at the University of West Florida in Pensacola. We sat down recently to talk about why the university started its doctorate in physical therapy.
There are a number of degrees that can get you in that pathway here on the campus, but there was no specific pathway for DPT.
So was there a demand?
There's a tremendous demand. There's, there's probably about 400 slots every year that are openings for people who have a DPT background, and we're not producing that many in the state. So there's a big need.
And is this going to be a competitive program, do you think?
Oh, I think it's going to be highly competitive, absolutely. For example, USF has about 40 slots, and there are over 1,000 or close to 1,000 applicants for those 40 slots every year. So it's extremely competitive. And our slots will be reserved for UWF graduates specifically. Even though there's only 12 slots, the competition will be much less stiff, at least up front, for those 12 slots. And when the program is full, there'll be 36 slots.
Let's talk about nationwide. It looks like this is going to be the gold standard now for physical therapy to get the doctorate.
Absolutely. No question about it. That standard has been set by the accrediting agency as well as by federal agencies that are involved in the process.
And what is the main difference? Is it just more training than if you go to somebody who is a physical therapist or a doctor of physical therapist? Is it just training, or is there something else there?
There's a lot more content. There's a lot more exposure to specific areas that will make you more competent in the field, and of course it's more intensive.
Now, physical therapy is becoming more specialized. There's sports medicine, geriatrics, rehab. Is this going to take in everything?
Well, the hope of the program does, in fact, train you to deal with those kinds of issues. But, of course, there are postdoctoral positions where you can get more skilled in certain areas. For example, most of our people in the program are going to be going probably to Andrews and to Select Hospital in West Florida and Sacred Heart and Baptist, all of whom have rehab centers. And depending on what their specialty is, that's what they'll get exposed to. But the truth of the matter is that they're going to get a great background with the USF program.
And there is a lot more demand for physical therapists nationwide, I guess.
That demand's going to increase as the population ages.
As I say, we're all getting a little older.
Right,
we're all
exactly.
going to need it.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. How about the growth of physical therapy? And I know there's a lot of advances in surgery. Has physical therapy also advanced to try to stave off some surgeries?
Oh, I think physical therapy is really critical for in terms of preparing people physically so that they don't have to get surgery quite often. And certainly rehabbing them post-surgery is also a very important part of what physical therapy does.
And you talked about aging too. And, and as we do get older and we're staying alive a lot longer, too.
Absolutely.
We're going to need ways to keep us moving and keep us active.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so this is going to be...
Physical therapy is also part of that picture, too.
It's going to be a really yep. growing field. Is there any concern about maybe people calling themselves doctor and there being confusion? Well, okay, he's a doctor. He must be an MD.
Well, as I understand it, at least in some legislatures, state legislatures, they're trying to get a passage of laws that state that you can only be called doctor if you have a physician's degree, an MD or a DO. I don't know how far that's going to go. I don't see any confusion in it, but, I guess maybe the docs do. The physicians may.
Well, let's talk about the timetable here at UWF. When is this set to start?
The application window extends through November 15th. That's the first application window this year. And that's for the program that starts in August of 2014.
And this is how long a program?
It's 3 years. They can go in immediately into physical therapy following their graduation from the program. Certainly they're prepared to do that. And there are a lot of jobs out there for them. But if they wanted to gain additional experience, they could go to a place like Andrews or Select and do a postdoctoral experience and gain some knowledge in a specific area if that was their interest.
Dr. George Stewart is the chair of the Department of Biology and director of the School of Allied Health and Life Sciences at the University of West Florida in Pensacola.
Put your hands up to the ceiling. Bend your hips and touch your toes.
And while we're on the topic of doctors and medical schools, let's talk about alternative medicine. If you're a big fan of alternative medicine and foregoing traditional so-called Western medical practices, you're probably not a big fan of my next guest. Dr. Paul Offit has been one of the biggest defenders of evidence-based medicine in the country and one of the loudest voices defending childhood vaccinations from people who contend they cause autism and other conditions. Dr. Offit is now taking on the whole practice of so-called alternative medicine in his book, Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. We spoke recently, and I asked him if mainstream medical schools are teaching any alternative practices.
I think that increasingly medical schools are starting to include curricula that where homeopaths, acupuncturists, even chiropractors teach. I'm not sure it's necessarily a good thing. I think that medical schools should stick to the scientific method. And certainly where alternative therapies work, I think that they should be educated about that and educated about why they work. But I'm worried, actually, that this has become so popular and that I think doctors often see this as a marketplace, that they're willing to teach their students things that sometimes are not well-grounded in science.
Why are Americans so fascinated by alternative medicine now? Is it just mistrust? Is it misplaced hopes? Or are some of the hopes well-placed?
I think it's a lot of things. I think there is a dissatisfaction at some level with conventional medicine. And certainly conventional medicine at some level brings this on themselves, where there's a lot that we treat certainly as outpatients that's self-limited. And sometimes we'll do things like give antibiotics for viral infections, which doesn't help and can only hurt. We give cough and cold preparations containing active ingredients like pseudoephedrine, which don't help and often hurt. And I think alternative therapies, while they may not make you better, I think generally are perceived as safer, even though that's not always the case.
When is that not the case?
Well, the problem is it's an unregulated industry. So, for example, if there are problems, and there have been problems, garlic can cause bleeding, thujone can cause neurological problems. There certainly was the L-tryptophan disaster in the late 1980s that caused about 25 people to die. So ephedra certainly could cause psychosis, hallucinations, and death. There was recently selenium poisoning associated with one of these products. So because it's not a regulated industry, often one doesn't have the guarantees, I think, of safety that can come with conventional products. Although at least what you can say about conventional products is that the FDA regulates them. So if they are unsafe, those unsafe issues have to be in the label and certainly have to be on commercials. That's not often the case with this industry.
When you're talking about unregulated, what are we just talking about, supplements, or are there other things we have to worry about there?
I'm talking about megavitamins, large doses of vitamins that are often in excess of the recommended daily allowance, and dietary supplements, of which there are upwards of 54,000 on the market.
How much of a factor are celebrities in this fascination?
I think they're a factor. You know, people believe that they know celebrities. They see them on the big screen or little screen, and they feel comfortable with them. When you see these companies putting these people up and Suzanne Somers telling you that she has ways to turn back the clock with her anti-aging medicines, or Jenny McCarthy says that she has medicines that can, treat or cure autism, I think that's seductive. And it's too bad. I mean, it should really never be about the person that says whether something works. It always should be about whether the data really show that it works.
Are there parts of the alternative medicine world that have been incorporated into conventional medicine and are working well?
Yes. So, for example, artemisia is a plant that was used by the Chinese 2,000 years ago to treat malaria. Now we know that one can purify from that artemisinin, which is a relatively new anti-malarial drug. So I would say probably at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, at least 30% of the drugs on our formulary are from plants, and often that starts in, quote-unquote, I guess, the alternative realm. It's all testable. I guess what bothers me is that many of these supplements have never been tested, and there are claims that are made that the clearly, as we're learning now, are untrue.
Well, where do we go from here with alternative medicine? Should there be like some kind of summit meeting between all of the practices and just decide what's good, what's bad, or is that just hoping for too much?
It's probably hoping for too much. I mean, the industry is very powerful. They're very politically connected and media savvy, and they've been very good at defeating the FDA's attempt to make them provide information. You know, I think, you know, as a consumer, you just want data. If you're going to go buy saw palmetto to shrink your prostate, where are the data that works? Or you're going to buy black cohosh to try and reduce the number of hot flashes you have associated with PMS, that's fine. But it would be nice to have data showing that works and showing that it's safe and labeling, you know, that's accurate. And unfortunately, because this is an unregulated industry, none of those things are for the most part true. We suffer with this, actually, at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, because there are many doctors who want to use dietary supplements, and frankly, it violates our home medication policy, which insists that when you bring in a medication that we can show that it is what it's claimed to be, and that's often not true with these products, which are occasionally are not what they're claimed to be. And I'm just talking about what's in the bottle, not whether it's safe and effective, whether when it says 200 milligrams of coenzyme Q10, that's really what it is.
The placebo effect, if it works, what's wrong with it?
Nothing. I think the placebo effect is underrated and misnamed. You know, when people hear the word placebo effect, I think they see that as dismissive and trivializing, and it's just all in your mind. But, you know, you can learn to upregulate and downregulate your own immune system. You can learn to release your own dopamine. You can learn to release your own endorphins, which are these pain-modifying chemicals that are made in our pituitary and hypothalamus. That's really cool. And I think, you know, some people, for example, that receive acupuncture, that benefit from acupuncture, no doubt have learned to release their own endorphins. And that's interesting. It probably has nothing to do with putting needles under the skin. But, you know, there's something about that therapeutic interaction that is valuable. And I think it's incumbent upon, I think, those who practice this form of medicine to show what physiologically or biologically is going on. I think they owe that to the medical community.
Well, you have your share of detractors. We hear about them every time you do come out with a book. Have you had any come at you lately?
Yes, I have. And you know, what's interesting to me is that, you know, previously I like to think that what my books are all the same. They're sort of about that interaction between science and belief. In the past, my books have just focused on the science of vaccines, you know, which end up, as it turns out, you know, vaccines are made by companies, and I support the science of vaccines. This is the first time I've actually gone up against companies, you know, and this is the pharmaceutical industry. Don't kid yourself. Well, you know, these products aren't made by elves and old hippies on mountainsides. This is the pharmaceutical industry. Pfizer is a major player in this game. So is Huffman LaRoche. So this is Big Pharma. It's Big Pharma on one side and the other. And, you know, their principal lobbying group, you know, has started to you know, to sort of target me, which is amazing to me that they would even bother. But, you know, this is a business, and, you know, you at some level are calling that business into question, and so it's sort of a level of attack I'm not used to.
Dr. Paul Loffitt is the chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the director of vaccine education at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He is also the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Dr. Loffitt's new book is Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. Still to come, an art professor in Maryland has the hottest class on campus. Literally. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the best of our knowledge, number 1193. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The average summer temperature in Washington, D.C. is about 85 degrees, and so far this summer is putting that number to shame. So why would anyone willingly agree to spend hours around a furnace that burns at more than 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit? Producer Lauren Ober takes a trip to the art department at the University of Maryland to find out.
Stephen Jones's office is hot. I mean, really hot. Like, melt your face off hot. Like, you need to drink a gallon of water every minute hot. Okay, you get the point. Jones is a sculptor and adjunct professor at University of Maryland, where he runs the metal casting program. The furnace Jones uses to heat up the metals burns at more than 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's hotter than a burning candle, a smoldering cigarette, even molten lava. Needless to say, Jones's job makes him a little bit sweaty.
So we always start with aluminum because it melts at a lower temperature, and then we'll put in the bronze crucible. We'll pull away the aluminum molds, bring out the bronze molds, and pour the bronze. Bronze melts around 1800. We probably pour it around 2100 degrees Fahrenheit. Aluminum melts at around 1100 degrees Fahrenheit. We pour around 1500 or 1600 degrees Fahrenheit.
So it's a hot business.
It is hot business, yes.
Jones has been teaching metal casting at Maryland for more than a decade. The class takes students through the process of creating a variety of molds, pouring the metals, and shining up the final pieces.
Today's the last day of class. It's our last pour. We'll be pouring aluminum and bronze. The students have a series of molds for aluminum and for bronze.
And when you say pour, what do you mean? What is actually going to happen?
The pour means that we will be melting the metal in a furnace, and then using a crane and some other tools to lift the molten metal out of the furnace and pour them into the molds. And inside of each mold is a cavity that is created by the students by either making a pattern or carving into the sand to accept the metal.
The molds the students have come up with span the sculptural spectrum. There's a relief of a face, an antique gun, even baby flip-flops. They get one last inspection before the big pour. Until then, the metal shop is buzzing with drills, wire brushes, and the sound of the furnace rumbling awake in the next room. The furnace is a special part of the sculpture department, Jones says. Not many university art programs have them anymore.
So the furnace has been here at University of Maryland in excess of 20 years, probably longer. It melts 125 pounds of aluminum, 475 pounds of bronze, which is a lot of aluminum, a lot of bronze. At University of Maryland, we have a fairly large and robust foundry and sculpture equipment area. 50 years ago, kids in junior high would have been doing aluminum casting, and they would have then gone into engineering and some other fields based on that hands-on experiences that they had. And now the art department is kind of the last venue of actually making in that way. So now we're getting the architects and the engineering students that come to us to actually learn how to weld and learn how to cast and learn some of the hands-on ways of making.
The process of heating up the metals begins with propane, which creates a little tornado of fire around the crucible. The crucible is the vessel that holds the metal within the furnace. As the heat rises around the crucible, the metal will start to melt. More metal is added until there is enough to fill all the molds. At full blast, the furnace spews a vibrant green flame from a hole in the top. It's so loud, it sounds like you're standing inside a jet engine. The heat is nearly unbearable. Imagine standing inches from a towering, white-hot bonfire. This is the type of heat the furnace throws off. At one point, I am pretty sure my glasses might melt down my face. While the metal melts, the students put on protective leather jackets, aprons, and safety glasses. Those who will be doing the pouring also wear helmets with face shields, thick leather gloves, and heavy leather spats.
All right, guys, it's going to be a little warm.
When the aluminum is ready, Jones gives the students orders with military precision.
Good job. All right, down a crank. Okay, you're on it. 3, 2, 1.
The crucible with the molten aluminum glows bright red as the students tip to pour the metal into the molds. When the molds are full, the rest of the aluminum is poured into forms that look like bread loaf pans. Those will be reheated and used in a future pour.
4, 3, 2, 1. A little slower, a little slower. Guys, great pour, great class. Y'all did a wonderful job. Y'all made some nice pieces. Great pouring to the pour teams. Now we're just going to let these cool, then come back and bust them open. All right, so great job. Congratulations.
Jones wipes the sweat from his brow as he says this. Then he encourages his students to drink lots of water to stay hydrated, as if they needed any more reminders of just how scorching this work can be. I'm Lauren Ober.
And Lauren's story originally appeared as part of the June 21st edition of the program Metro Connection on WAMU Radio in Washington, D.C. Things could get even hotter if our galaxy hooks up with another nearby galaxy. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. We usually think of the Milky Way as a relatively calm place to go about our business. But as Kelly Holly Bockelman, assistant professor in physics and astronomy at Vanderbilt University, demonstrates, the process of mergers and acquisitions made for a volatile past.
Our Milky Way core is a pretty calm place right now. Sure, there's a massive black hole lurking there, but this supermassive monster isn't actively devouring stars, so it's dim and quiet. But there are forensic clues suggesting that a violent event took place at the heart of our Milky Way just 10 million years ago, one that forever changed the structure of our galactic core. Clue number one is that our galactic center is teeming with new stars, all born at about that same time. Clue two is the newly discovered Fermi bubbles, two enormous galaxy-sized globes of gamma-ray light spouting from the core. Clue three is that the center is strangely missing tens of thousands of old stars. My team and I suggest that all these clues can be explained by one single small galaxy collision. As this small galaxy plummeted toward us, it was shredded until only a mere skeleton of stars and its own central black hole remained, and it disturbed the gas in our galaxy core, setting off a new burst of star formation. The remaining disturbed gas funneled into our black hole. The Fermi bubbles are just its energetic burp after a gas-rich meal. Now, what about those missing older stars? We suggest that when our supermassive black hole meets the one in the other galaxy, the two black holes pair up and spin around each other in a relativistic dance that flings out any stars veering too close. Now, unlike a criminal trial, a verdict on the Milky Way mystery doesn't come from a jury of peers, but from more hard evidence. Evidence that either exonerates a satellite collision or that confirms it. Our smoking gun would be finding the missing old stars. They'd be flung from the galactic center at breakneck speeds, and we're searching for them right now.
That was Kelly Holly Bockelman of Vanderbilt University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.